So yesterday we looked at we saw a farmer observing Masechet Peah. The farmer was in various stages of harvesting his crops, be it a field, be it a vineyard, or an olive grove, or an orchard of some sort, and he had to leave various sort of leftovers, if you will, from the manufacturing process, or I guess manufacturing is not the right term, but from the harvest. He had to leave leket, shikcha, peah, peret, and ololot, and akerem, etc. Today, we're going to look at a sampling of Mishnayot from actually three different Masechtot, Trumot, Ma'asrot, and Ma'aser Sheni. And this discusses what I guess you can refer to as the income tax that the Torah imposes on the farmer. In other words, after he's harvested his crops, and he has his income, his gross income, so before he's allowed to benefit from itself, or for that matter, before any of us are able to buy from him, and I'll just close the door. Benefit from the produce, so there are certain hafrashot, there are certain allocations, I guess you can say, that have to be removed from the produce and given to various different sources. This is actually a complex system, a multi-year system, built around the 7 years of the Shemitah cycle. The seventh year, which is what we'll learn about Bezrat Hashem tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to look at Masechet Shvi'it, which discusses the laws of the seventh year of the Shemitah year. And that, we'll see, has a whole different set of rules. But in the other 6 years, it's a multi-year cycle, during which different hafrashot are taken off. And part of what makes it complicated is that the Torah, all these things are spelled out in the Torah Shebichtav, in the Bible, but the Torah does not present it to us in a sort of systematic fashion. The Torah scatters it in various places throughout the books of Vayikra, Bamidbar, and Dvarim. And it was the job of Torah Shebaal Peh, the rabbis, to sort of put this whole thing together. In the interest of time, trying to pack all of this into 1 hour, I cannot do it all inside the Mishnah. We just don't have enough time to do that. So what we're going to do is, we're going to look first of all at the sources in the Torah. And then I made a little chart for you, so I can sort of explain to you how it works. And then we'll look at some of the details in the Mishnayot. Okay? So let's begin with the biblical sources, and you'll see here on the first two pages there are a total of 5 different categories under what we call trumot and ma'asrot. And I presented them to you also in the order in which they're supposed to be done, and as you'll see, it makes a difference the order in which they're taken. Okay, so let's begin with truma gedola. The Psukim and Dvarim tell us, Lo yihye la kohanim halevim kol shevet levi chelek v'nachalayim Yisrael Hashem v'nachalato yochelun. And again, to understand that Pasuk in its full significance, we have to remember what we spoke about yesterday, which is that these laws are presented to an agricultural society. We have a situation where each shevet, each tribe, has its own nachala, right? We are presently situated, I believe, we are right on the border between shevet Yehuda and Binyamin here. I have to figure out exactly which line. Mamash on the border here. Nachal Rifaim, I think just south of here. We're actually in shevet Binyamin right now, but you walk a block or two and you're in shevet Yehuda. Every shevet got their own, area of the country, and within that, each family, a plot of land, and that's where you live. And it's from that you earn your livelihood. Those are the fields. One tribe, Shevet Levi, has no land. And of course, and again, to us modern industrialized people, when we hear that and we see the map, and we understand that, if you've read, for example, the book of Yoshua, which details this, or the book of Divrei Hayamim, which details it in even greater detail, and we see that each tribe set aside cities for the Leviim, so that they could live among all the people and they could serve the functions of the educators and the spiritual leaders, the rabbis, if you will. So that has one aspect that we can all very readily understand, the need for people to have access. If all the educators, you know, like where I live in Alon Shvut, where, you know, over 50% of the population are teachers, all locked up in one little town, so we have wonderful shiurim on Shabbat afternoon, but I sometimes ask myself whether this is the best use of, I enjoy it, but I'm not sure whether it's the best use of such resources. Right? So the Torah has, took all the educators and scattered them around the country. But what that also means, though, in an agricultural society, is that they don't have land. They live in cities. They have small plots of land around the cities where they can grow a little bit of vegetables. But you cannot really, really grow. That means that they have no livelihood. They have no income, right? And therefore, the Torah has to deal with that. It has to provide them with an income. Lo yihyeh la'kohanim ha'leviim kol shevet levi chelek v'nachala im Yisrael. Right? They don't have a nachala. That means they don't have land. That means they don't have the ability to support themselves, at least not fully. So what are they supposed to do? Ishei Hashem v'nachalato yochelun. They are to be supported. They will eat. They will earn their sustenance from Ishei Hashem. That refers to sacrifices. That's not what we're talking about here. Right? But part of the system is that both Kohanim and Levim have a rotation in the Beit HaMikdash, and at least during those times, they're provided for from the Korbanot that are provided in the Beit, more the Kohanim than the Levim, but they're provided for in the Beit HaMikdash. That's part of it. But Nachalato refers to the agricultural land. They're supported from the Nachala, from the inheritance, from the land of God. What does that mean? So the Torah explains, "V'nachala lo yielo bekerav echav, Hashem hu nachalato." God is his land. He works in holy work, and God is his inheritance. That's very nice, but how do you eat from that, right? So the Torah spells that out. I actually skipped a pasuk here because it's not relevant to our topic. But in the next pasuk, Reshit degancha tiroshcha v'yitzarcha. You have to provide him with the first of your dagan, tirosh, v'yitzar. Those are the three main agricultural crops I think we mentioned yesterday. Grains, wine, and oil. And also something else that we're not going to speak about today, but just so you should know, reshit geiz tzoncha. Another major agricultural branch of agricultural activity are the shepherds. Right? The shepherds that live at the edge of the desert. Right, and some of the tribes, we know that David HaMelech, for example, who lived not far from here, was a shepherd. When you raise sheep and goats, it's done for several reasons. You get milk from them, of course. You can get meat from them, and you also, primarily, I think, you shear the wool, and the wool is the main product. So from the wool as well, you have to give a certain percentage to the Kohanim. So in other words, what's going on here is that the Kohanim, who don't have their own land, they are being supported by these. It's not charity. It's not charity. That we spoke about yesterday. This is a tax. And the way the Torah presents it is that, look, this one tribe out of the 12 was set aside to serve a purpose. Their job is to be the spiritual guides, the rabbis, the teachers, the educators, maybe even the judges. And therefore, they're going to be living among the tribes, and they are going to be supported from the produce of the land among whom they live. And therefore, from when you harvest your own crops or when you shear your sheep, you have to take the beginnings of that and give it to the Kohen. The Torah here does not spell out for us how much you have to give. We'll get to that a bit later on. Okay, so that's Truma. But it's described as Nachalat Hashem. It's described not only as a tax in the economic sense, but it's being described to us that the Kohanim are eating from God's produce. And we'll see that phrase has legal halachic ramifications as well. That's Truma Gedola. Next we come to Ma'aser Rishon. That goes to the Kohanim. The Truma that we just spoke about goes to the Kohanim. Ma'aser Rishon, V'livnei Levi, to the Levites, Hine natati kol ma'aser b'Yisrael l'nachala. Again, the word nachala, their inheritance, or that which comes in place of their inheritance, they don't have land. Instead, they get ma'aser b'Yisrael. Chelech avodatam asher heim ovdim et avodat ol moed. Here it's spelled out explicitly. This is a salary. It's not charity. It's a salary that's paid to them in return for the work that they do, the holy work, so to speak, that they do in the Ohel Moed. But unlike Truma, here the Torah gives us a word which tells us very clearly how much, what percentage we're talking about. What does the word Ma'aser mean? 10%, 1/10. Right? So we're told the first of the produce has to be given to the Kohen, and that's called Nachalat Hashem. And I should write this down. We'll see the significance of these terms in a minute. Truma is called Reshit. It's called the first. And it's called Nachalat Hashem, God's inheritance. And then we have Ma'aser, which is to the Levi, and that's called a Nachalat. It's called an inheritance, but it's not called God's inheritance, and it's clearly one-tenth.
Isn't the first a little ambiguous? The Truma Nolas is, as far as whether it's Kohanim or Leviim. Is this Kohanim HaLeviim?
Well, it says Kohanim HaLeviim, but what that means is that the Kohanim are also part of the tribe of Levi. So they're sometimes called Kohanim Leviim. But they're the Kohanim, maybe we can translate it.
It says Kol Shevet.
Right, it does say that. That's, well, you're correct. You're correct. Because that Pasuk, you're correct. That Pasuk is clear for both of them. Yeah, there is another Pasuk that I didn't place on the sheet here that makes it a little bit more clear. You're correct, though. There's a Pasuk in Vayikra that makes it a little bit more clear. But in any case, it's understood by the rabbis to refer to that. Yes. Yes, because the Truma is Reshit, has to be first, right? What's remaining, that's going to change the percentages, correct. Okay, depending on how much Truma is, it might be more or less significant, we'll see. Yes? You know what, let me finish because I'm going to go over the whole thing again. Okay, so let me just read a little more. I'll even give you a concrete example of this, okay? Trumat Ma'aser comes next. Vaydaber Hashem Moshe Lemur. Ve'el ha-Levi'im tadaber. This is a mitzvah given to the Levi'im. Ha-Mata lehem. Ki tikchu me'et b'nei Yisrael et ha-Ma'aser, asher natati lachem me'itam b'nachalatchem. When you receive the tenth, the tithe, the Ma'aser that is given to you, all the people are giving you one-tenth of their produce from their Nachalah. V'haremote mimenu trumat Hashem Ma'aser min ha-Ma'aser. You then have to take a truma. And again, here it's referred to as God's truma. Ma'aser min ha-ma'aser. A tenth of the tenth. V'nechshav lachem trumatchem kidagan min ha-goren v'chamlaya min ha-yekev. What you take from your produce, from your gift that you were given, will be considered like as if you took it from the threshing field or from the wine press. Kein tarimu gam atem trumat Hashem mikol masrotechem. You also have to take a truma to God. Like that. V'nechshav, I'm skipping to the end there. V'nechshav l'alviim kitvuat goren. In other words, it's a beautiful idea. The farmer has to give things to the Kohen, and that's referred to as God's inheritance that the Kohen lives from. Right? And then that's Truma Gedola that the farmer gives, right? The farmer then gives Ma'aseri to the Levi. And the Levi is to view his Ma'aser as if it's his crop. So he also has to take Truma and give it to the Kohen. And that's also called Trumat Hashem. Unlike the farmer, though, where the Torah didn't spell out a percentage, to the Levi it did. He has to give one-tenth of his tenth, Ma'aser min ha-Ma'aser, and the rabbis refer to this as Trumat Ma'aser. Okay? So this is given by the Levi, and
it's a Ma'aser of the Ma'aser.
It's a Ma'aser of the Ma'aser, so it's a tenth of a tenth. So I'm going to write one-tenth here, but it's one-hundredth
right.
Of the, well, it's actually, we'll see, I'll show you this all in a minute. And it says v'nechshav lachem kitvuat goren, from which the rabbis understood this is going to have all the same rules as truma, all the same laws as truma, although we haven't yet seen what those laws are. Okay, in a minute we're going to put all this together and it's going to make sense. Okay, so this is what we've read first in Dvarim and then in Bamidbar. By the way, the psukim that I gave you in what I wrote here as source number 2 and source number 3 are contiguous. I broke it up into two different sections. But if you look, it's verses 21 through 30. It goes straight, right? The Torah presents those two together.
Does it discuss why the Levim have to give a tenth of their tenth to the Kohen?
I hesitate to use the word why, because that's going to get us into speculation. But it does say very clearly that, and this has both conceptual and halachic ramifications, that the truma that the Levi gives from his ma'aser is to be considered as if it came from a farmer, as if it came from directly from the field. Okay, so it seems that the concept is, again, I hesitate to say why, but it seems that the concept is that, look, the farmer works in the field, he has a field. The Levi doesn't have a field. He's given a gift, but he is to view that as if he harvested from the field and take a gift and give it to the Kohen, the same as the farmer. And realize, if you think about it in terms of taxation even, right? When the Levi gets it, the Kohen has already gotten his gift from that crop. And now it's like double taxation, right? And now the Levi has to go and take it again, right? Yes?
You just said the word, and this is a gift. But a minute ago you said that was salary, not charity, the number two.
You're right.
So which is it? Because
you're correct. You're correct.
You're not giving me a present.
You're correct.
A present means I sit here, watch TV, and then you pay me. But if you pay me, I did work.
I accept the point. Correct. You're right. The Torah does use the word matana, but I agree with you. The ambiguity here is coming from the translation of the term, because the Hebrew word matana is something which has been given, but it doesn't have to be given as... The English word gift contains the implication gift without a...
Labor.
Right. Listen, it's not a salary in the legal sense of the term, in the sense that... it's not being paid directly for services, right? And for that matter, a lady who does sit around and do nothing is still entitled to it, although we'll see that he probably won't get it. I'll show you why in a minute. Okay? It's a fascinating...
Shall we erase the word salary?
Compensation?
Well, maybe what we should say, to be honest with you, I haven't thought this through, Phil. You're showing me a fascinating insight here. But, no, don't be embarrassed. I think you just noticed something fascinating. On the one hand, the Torah uses the term matana, matnotechem, right? On the other hand, right, where does it say that? It says that verse 29. Mikol matnotechem tarimu. From all of your gifts, you have to take truma. So what the Levi gets is referred to as a matana. On the other hand, it's said to him earlier, it's referred to as chelef avodatchem. Now that's, in a sense, a bit of a contradiction, right? It's a gift, it's not a salary, it's a gift that's given in exchange for work. And perhaps that is, which makes it sound like a salary.
Yes.
So one can view that as a contradiction, or perhaps there's some dual aspect to it here.
That's a dual
aspect. Okay, and I think we'll see what that is in 1 minute. That's a fascinating insight. What's your name, ma'am? I'm sorry?
Rosemary.
That's a fascinating insight that I never noticed before, but I'll show you perhaps what it leads to. Maybe.
Maybe. That's a different concept.
Yeah, maybe. Perhaps. It's an interesting question. Okay, now we have what the rabbis refer to as Maaser Sheni. This is an even more fascinating. Here we certainly can't use the word gift. I'll show you why. The Torah tells us, and this is in the book of Dvarim, Aser ta'aser et kol tvuat zarecha hayotzei asadeh shana shana. You shall tithe that which comes from your land every year. Now, we already learned about a ma'aser. So perhaps I might have read these psukim, and my initial reaction might have been that this is repeating or perhaps elaborating on the law that we already learned, that you have to give ma'aser to the Levi. However, when you read on, it seems that it's very clear that that's not what this is talking about. This is something else. And therefore, the rabbis understood that this is a second type, a ma'aser sheni, which is given after the Maaser Rishon, which is going to mean that it's going to be a smaller percentage, because it's 10% of what's left. Okay, we'll work this out in a minute. So what happens here? What do you do with this? Who do you give it to? You don't give it to anyone. What do you do with it? Ve'achalta lifnei Hashem Elokecha b'makom asher yivchar v'shaken shmo shach. You have to take it to the place where God's spirit rests. In other words, to the Beit HaMikdash, to Yerushalayim, and you have to eat it there. It's considered a tithe, a ma'aser. But unlike Truma, which is given to the Kohen, unlike Ma'aser, which is given to the Levi, Ma'aser Rishon, which is given to the Levi, and unlike the Matnot Aniyim that are given to the poor people, I have to separate this out. And what do I do with it? I keep it. But I don't eat it in my house. I take it to Jerusalem, and I eat it in Jerusalem with Nei Hashem, by which the rabbis understood that this law only applies when there is a Beit HaMikdash. Because it has to be done in front of God. And in front of God is understood by the rabbis to mean when God's presence dwells in the Beit HaMikdash, and you come there within the city of Yerushalayim, you are before God. You are the Fnei Hashem. You eat it there. And then the Torah even recognizes that this can cause a bit of a difficulty. Let's say I live in the Golan, and I have vineyards, right? And I have, thank God, I've been blessed with an abundant crop, and I have much land, and I have to take, even if it'll be a little bit less than a tenth, it's going to come out to be about 9% of my crops, and bring them all to Jerusalem. I have to hire a fleet of trucks to carry all these grapes to Jerusalem, and then I have to sit in Jerusalem eating grapes. How long is that going to take? And it may spoil at the meantime. So their Torah provides for a way around this technical difficulty. And if the road to Jerusalem is too far, it's too long, kilo tuchal seito, you cannot carry all of that with you. Kirchak mimcha makom asher yivchar Hashem lokecha v'chulei, it's too far away. So then, v'natata b'kesef, you can somehow transfer it into money. We'll talk about how to do that. But basically what you're going to do is you're going to transfer the holiness of these fruits to money. And you're going to leave the fruits in the Golan, you'll sell them, you'll eat them, you'll do whatever you're going to do with them. And instead you're going to have a bag of gold, which is a lot easier to carry than truckloads of grapes. V'tzarta ha-kesef bi'adecha, take the money with you, v'halachte el ha-makom asher yivchar Hashem lokecha bo, and go to Yerushalayim, v'natata ha-kesef b'chol asher taveh nafshecha b'bakar v'atzon v'yayin v'sheichar. And then you go in Yerushalayim and you buy food with that. You don't have to buy grapes with it either. You can go out to a nice restaurant and buy yourself steak and fancy wine and whatever. Bakar, batzon, yayin v'sheichar, wine, whiskey, meat. Go to the finest restaurant of Yerushalayim and buy yourself a really expensive meal. V'achal tasham b'fnei Hashem elokecha v'samachta ta uveitecha. This is a fascinating idea. I'm sorry? Oh, excellent question.
It's a lot of food.
Okay.
Okay, you partake it with all your friends and everybody, but it's a lot of food.
Okay, so hold on to that. We're going to see a mission in the end that perhaps deals with that issue. Okay? But just on a simple answer, immediately, well, there's two answers. First of all, again, you can spend it on expensive food, as we saw.
Right.
You could take the grapes. You know, many, many, many kilos of grapes could buy, you know, a very, very fancy, expensive steak and whatever. But still, it seems that you may have to share it with other people, and that may be part of this as well. Okay, but it's not a gift to the poor. It's something else.
You have to share
right.
It, but you know, you are not the only one who comes
correct.
To Jerusalem and has to share it, so
exactly.
There's some problem here.
Exactly. Okay, but then there's one, yes?
This phrase here, referring to one verse, I share it to Shalom, and all that your soul desires, that's like, it's superfluous.
Whatever you want.
Take the money, buy food, and eat. Why do they say everything that your soul desires? What does that mean?
The rabbis are going to learn from this phrase and from the phrases surrounding it what types of food you're allowed to buy with this money.
Oh.
We're going to see that there are certain limitations to what you're allowed to buy and what you're
allowed to eat. Something.
Yeah, we'll get to it in a minute.
Right.
Correct. Correct. But on the level of pshat, right, in other words, when the rabbis looked at psukim, they did it on multiple levels. Right? They read legal meaning. That's what Torah Shebaal Peh, that's what the oral law does. It you know, from every word and every phrase and comparisons to other words, they derive legal principles. But it also can be read as a text. And on the level of the pshat, on the level of the text, without getting into the legal nuances yet, I think part of what it's driving at is the idea that you may have harvested one sort of crop, right? But you don't have to spend it on that. You can spend it on whatever you want. Whereas the idea is to take it and eat it in Jerusalem. The idea, and part of that, assumedly, I've often wondered, what's the idea of this mitzvah? I'm just keeping my eye on the clock, so I have to be very careful because I have a lot to do. But I've often wondered, what's the idea of this mitzvah? It's so different. You tell me I have to support poor people, I understand that. You're telling me I have to support the Kohanim and the Levim, so that there's, you know, the spiritual leadership of the nation and the education, and I understand that. You tell me I'm allowed to take something from my own family also, I certainly understand that. If it's mine, but you tell me I have to eat it, what exactly does that mean? It sort of forces people to take a vacation in Yerushalayim, and a spiritual vacation. It forces you, right? It forces you to take money, and you're not... Right, and you know, once upon a time they had this concept here that they still have in Israel, Dmei Havra'ah. This is a socialist country, right? Every year you get in your paycheck a couple of thousand shekels that you're supposed to use for a vacation, right? In the summer, in August or something, you get a little bit of extra money, and you're supposed to be able to take that money. And in the old days with the workers' unions here, they used to have like deals. You had to, I think in some companies you were even forced to use it for that. You could go to these like guest houses in kibbutzim and relax. You know, they force you to take a vacation. So the Torah is actually doing that in a sense. And you can't take the money and say, you know, I can't afford it. I can't afford it. I can't afford to go and spend fancy, you know, the hotels in Yerushalayim are expensive. I can't afford it. You can't do anything else with it. Take it to Yerushalayim, and you know what? Blow it on a fancy meal if you want, but you're going to have to be there in the spiritual atmosphere of Yerushalayim. It's a fascinating idea, and it's not going to help anyone. It may help other people, but that's not what this mitzvah is about, because you can keep it all for yourself, but you have to eat it in Yerushalayim. I'm just rushing the clock here. Right.
So it's about taking the time to thank Hashem.
I think you're right. And by the way, on a practical level, that's an excellent comparison. On a practical level, most of the time, especially if you live far from Yerushalayim, when would you do this? You do it on the Chagim when you have to come to Yerushalayim. You can use it any time of year. But practically speaking, if you're going to be traveling to Jerusalem a few times a year, you're going to take your Maaser Sheni, or the money of the Maaser Sheni, you're going to use it then. Right? So it's sort of building the infrastructure for that spiritual experience. I agree with you. Excellent. Okay, one more thing. The Torah then says, so now we have this, but then the Torah throws one more monkey wrench into this. And then we're going to have to make Seder out of all of this. Miktzei shalosh shanim, at the end of 3 years, totzi et kol ma'asar tuatcha bashana ha'u, you have to take all the ma'aser of that year, vinachta bisharecha, and leave it in your gates. In other words, in your gates means in your local precinct, as opposed to taking it, let's say, to Yerushalayim. And what do you do with it? You leave it there. V'hinachta. Uva ha-Levi. The Levi comes. But we already gave the Levi. So this is talking about something else now. Here it says, ha-Levi ki ein lo chelek v'nachala imach, v'ha-ger v'ha-yaton v'ha-almana, asher b'sharecha, v'achlu v'saveyu. And they shall eat. So here we have a ma'aser that is being given to Levi, Ger, Yaton, Almana. Here the Levi appears not as the one who is being repaid or recompensed or entitlement or whatever term we're going to use for his service, but here he appears in the context of someone who may be poor. Yeah. He's thrown in, lumped together with the widow and the orphan and the impoverished person and the Ger, the stranger who has no land. So we have a maaser that's being given to poor people. Now, is this a third tithe? Do I have to take a tenth for maaser rishon, a tenth for maaser sheni, and then a tenth for this? Maybe. But then, it says here, miktzei shalosh shanim, that this happens at the end of 3 years. And the way the rabbis understood this through the principles of Torah Shabbat Peh is that there's a seven-year cycle, as we spoke about. The seventh year, the Shemitah year, we'll talk about tomorrow, that has its own rules. If I remove that from the picture, there are 6 years. And the 6 years are divided into two sets of three. The first and the second year, we take Maaser Sheni. And then the third year, we take Maaser Ani. The fourth and the fifth year, Maaser Sheni. The sixth year, Maaser Ani. So that spiritual vacation in Yerushalayim, the money that's going to hang out in Jerusalem and eat it myself, that happens 4 out of the 6 years. But the third year and the sixth year, I don't take it to Yerushalayim. I stay home, or if I go to Yerushalayim, that's out of my own funds from elsewhere. And instead, the money that would have gone, or the crops that would have gone to Maaser Sheni, is an extra gift for the poor people. The poor people still got their leket, shik, chapeya, and all the other things we spoke about yesterday. But in the third year and the sixth year, they get an additional gift, or an additional benefit, whatever term we're going to use, called Maaser Ani. In order to sort of dramatize this a little bit and let's understand this, let's take a theoretical case. Let me erase this. We're going to have a guy who lives up in the Golan, and he has vineyards. He has vineyards. And he harvested his vineyards, and he came up with, and I'm doing this number for a reason, he came up with 102 kilos of grapes. That's his crop. He left the peret and the ololot and the peyah already when he was harvesting, and the poor people came and picked up whatever was left on the vines or anything that fell down, and a bit at the end. He did all that, but now he harvested his grapes, and he looks at his crops, and he has 102 kilos, or maybe I should use it's actually measured in volume, not in weight, 102 units, whatever they are, 102 boxes of grapes. Okay? And he now has to say, what am I going to do with all this? With all this. So the first thing, so let's go through this. Let's help our farmer here. He's got 102 boxes of grapes, cartons, crates, truckloads, whatever they are, of grapes. He now has to take off, pay his taxes, take off all the trumot and masrot. So let's help him. What's the first thing he has to do? Truma gedola. We haven't figured out how much he has to take. I made this number for a reason, and in a few minutes you'll see why, but I'm going to say that he's going to take two of them, and he's going to give them for Truma Gedola, and that's going to go to whom? To the Kohen. Okay. That leaves him with 100. You'll see how I came up with the number two in a minute. But that leaves him with 100. He now has to take, what's next? Maser Rishon. How many is that going to be?
10.
So 10 of them is going to go to Maaser Rishon. Who's that going to go to? It's going to go to the Levi. However, the Levi, when he gets it, he has to do something. He has to take 1/10 of 1/10, right? He has to give Truma Maaser to the Kohen. So now the Kohen has 3, and the Levi has 9. Okay? And then, our farmer is left at this point with 90. From which he does what? Maser Sheni or Maser Ani, depending on which year it is. But either way, it's going to be 9. So notice that Maser Sheni is a smaller percentage. It's really only 9%, a little less than 9% even. Right? Because it's a tenth after you've taken off the Truma and the Maaser Rishon. So this is going to go either to Maaser Sheni, which he will take to Yerushalayim, or it's going to go to Maaser Ani, in which case it goes, of course, to the poor person. And then he's left at the end with 81. Okay, and this 81 is now permitted for use. This is now called Chulin. It's regular, plain old ordinary grapes. This is what he can use to feed his family. This is what he can use to take to the marketplace to make wine from, whatever he wants to. This is his net income. He started with 102. His net income is 81. He paid roughly 20% taxes. And where did it go? In the end, 3% went to the Kohen, 2% from him directly, and, well, actually, yeah, around 2% from him directly, and another 1% via the 10% that he gave to the Levi. The Levi went up with around 9, with 9, and then 9 went either to Maaser Sheni or to poor people, and he's left with 81. This is his net income. And I have a chart here that basically summarizes this and a few of the other laws that we'll... let's look at this chart for a minute, and then we'll... I know this was supposed to be a Mishnah class, but we'll do Mishnayot for about 20 minutes. Most of what's on this chart we already spoke about. I want to just focus on the last column, the status, the ma'amad of these fruits. Notice that when we spoke about truma, the Torah used the phrase trumat Hashem, right? Belongs to God. And when it came to also the trumat ma'aser, that the Levi has to give to the Kohen, it also spoke about Nachalat Hashem. God's name was evoked in connection with Truma, and not in connection with the Ma'aser. Maaser was simply called his nachala, the Levi's inheritance, the Levi's portion. And although there's a dispute about this in the Talmud, the bottom line conclusion, at least that what's accepted lehalacha, is that there's a fundamental difference between truma that goes to the Kohen and the maaser that goes to the Levi. The maaser that goes to the Levi is a monetary transaction. It belongs to him. Just like anything else that a person grew in his own field, or bought in the marketplace, or was paid as wages for work. That's what maaser is. Or a poor person who received charity, it then becomes his property and he now owns it. That's what maaser is. But it has no specific status. Once the Levi receives it, he can do with it as he chooses. He can eat it. He can give it to someone else. He can sell it. Truma, however, is different. Truma also is a financial transaction in the sense that it has to be given to the Kohen. But the Kohen, when he receives it, he is restricted in what he's allowed to do with it. It is holy. Only Kohanim can eat Truma. So, the Kohen can eat it, his wife can eat it, his children can eat it, he can even feed it to his animals. But someone who's not a Kohen is not allowed to eat it. So if a Kohen invites me over to his house for dinner, he cannot serve me food that he received as Truma. If a Levi invites me over to his house for dinner, he can feed me food that he received as Matzer Rishon, because there's no significance to that food. It was a financial transaction. It belongs to him. But once he receives it, it's also chulin. It also has no special status. That's the case of the Truma. Additionally, Truma has to be eaten b'tahara. If a person is tameh, if a person is impure, whatever that term means, and that's, I see we're only getting through three orders of the Mishnah. We're not going to get to Seder Taharot. The laws of Tumah v'Tahara perhaps are from some other time. And even trying to figure out what that term means, it's often translated as impure, although that's, I don't know if there's a better translation into English, but it's certainly not an accurate translation either. But whatever Tumah is, whatever the state that's translated as spiritual impurity is, if a person's in that state, or if the food itself contracts Tumah and becomes Tameh, then it cannot be eaten when we're dealing with Truma. But that's not the case with Maaser. Okay, so that's one of the reasons I mentioned yesterday, and I'll try at the end to spend just two or three minutes on this. It's one of the reasons why yesterday we said that the laws of Matnot Aniyim, the Peah, the Leket, etc., are laws which in theory apply today, but we cannot really observe them because the poor people aren't going to come because it doesn't really help them to do it in the way it's done, and therefore, in the end, we don't observe the letter of the law, and we have to try to figure out how to observe the spirit of the law. In our case, what we're studying today, it's going to be the exact opposite. The spirit of the law, we cannot fulfill. We cannot support the Kohanim, for example, from the Truma, for a number of reasons, one of which is that today, no one's allowed to eat Truma. Because today we're all Tameh. And although there are certain forms of Tum'ah that we can deal with today, we can go to the mikveh, we cannot remove, until we have the red heifer, the parah adumah, right? Anyone who's ever been once in their life in a cemetery or in a room with a dead person, or has ever come into physical contact with another person who once in their life was ever in such a situation, which is obviously all of us, is in a state of tumah that is perpetual until the time comes that we once again have parah adumah. Therefore, even if we could solve all the other problems, we cannot give the Kohanim, there are other reasons too, but we cannot give the Kohanim the truma. It can't be eaten today. So we can't use it for what it's meant for, and yet we still have to, on some level, remove it from the produce. That's true for truma. As I said, maaser rishon is not holy. Trumat maaser, the Torah told us, is exactly the same as truma. It's different only in its source. But once it's defined, it has all the same rules, and therefore trumat maaser, the three boxes of grapes that the Kohen got, even though he may have gotten two of them from the farmer and one from the Levi, they have the exact same status, they're identical, and therefore all the same rules apply. Maaser sheni is also holy. It can be eaten by anyone. It doesn't have to be a Kohen, but it has to be eaten in Yerushalayim. And it also has to be eaten b'tahara. You have to be pure, and the food has to be pure. So Maaser Sheni also, today, we cannot do what we're supposed to with it, unfortunately. Maaser Ani is chulin. Maaser Ani is to be given to poor people, and it has no special status. In the end, the only one of these gifts that we can fulfill properly today is Maaser Ani. In theory, Maaser Rishon also can be done properly, but there's an additional factor that needs to be determined, and that is that we don't really know today who the Kohanim and who the Levim are. I'm a Levi. I say that because my father told me I'm a Levi, and he told me that because his father told him that. But we've been in exile for a couple of thousand years, and we're not really sure. And if I could prove legally that I'm a Levi, I could become very wealthy because I could have a legal claim to all of the Maaser Rishon in this country, at least under Torah law. But I say I'm a Levi. They call me up for the Torah second. I get the second Aliyah. I go out and I wash the Kohen's hands, but I don't have a claim that would stand up in court. And therefore, there are people who, you know, like to give Maaser Rishon to a Levi, but on the industrial scale today, it's not done because there's no way to prove who the Levi is. And since it has no holiness, basically the assumption is, okay, it belongs to Levim. If someone proves he's a Levi, we'll give it to him. In the meantime, no one can prove that. So
also, the Levi had to do a certain job that they're not today.
Okay, that could be also.
You could say you're teaching Torah, so therefore
right.
Your salary is already earned.
Right, but I
whatever.
Don't have to be a Levi to do that, right. So the only one of these that we can actually observe today is Maaser Ani. Unfortunately, there are people that are poor that can be verified as poor. We know exactly who they are. And there are no restrictions on giving it to them. It doesn't have any holiness or anything of that nature. Whether they're actually receiving Maaser Ani is an interesting question. There are people who do. I don't believe it's being done really on the industrial level. But that's a different discussion.
Is there a percentage that is mentioned that has to be given?
Yeah. It turns out to be 9%. 9% only every two out of the 6 years, right? The third year and the sixth year, right? This is a Maaser Sheni year. This is the fifth year. This is the fifth year, right? It's more complicated. Also, I can't go into this now. But for fruits and vegetables that are harvested after Rosh Hashanah, it'll be the sixth year. For vegetables and grains that are harvested after Rosh Hashanah. For fruits on trees, it's only after Tu B'Shvat, so it's next summer's fruits. Those will be Maaser Ani. And there are people who, people in their private gardens at least, who are careful of these things, do give Maaser Ani. And there are ways to do it also without having to hold on to, you know, a piece of a fruit and give it to him. There are ways to work out the economics in such a way that the poor person actually benefits much more than he would by trying to give him a half of an apple at a time, and actually fulfills the mitzvah. I don't have time to go into it now, but that is the one aspect of these mitzvot that can be fulfilled properly even nowadays. Yes? Well, remember, they had the leket and the shikha and the peah, the things we spoke about yesterday. So every 3 years they have an additional amount, and perhaps that's meant to help them through. Right, how to. Right, right. I'm sorry? Yes, yes. That's a good question. Right. Right. Well, first of all, you're talking about just grapes. I thought you were also talking about the fact that the percentages are so much smaller.
No.
Cohen is getting three, and the lady's getting three times as much.
Yes, but if you're a Cohen, and you're getting the
milk. And you also cannot sell it. That's true. That's a good point. That's a good point. Okay, so let me address both of those points, and I'll get there. So, first of all, the point that I thought you were asking, part of it is that there were less Kohanim than Levim. Right, so if the Levi, if 9% is to be spread out among all the Levim and 3%, that's part of it. The Kohen does have other sources of income as well. He has Reshit HaGez, we saw. He has the first of the wool that's shorn off sheep, and that he can sell and do what he wants with the money. He gets also challah. Whenever we bake bread, we have to take off a percentage of the challah. That's also a mitzvah that we do today, but we don't give it to the Kohen. Again, because we don't really know that he's a Kohen, and it's Tameh, so we burn it. But it's supposed to be given to the Kohen. And that's a mitzvah that we all do if we, in our own kitchens or in the bakeries and the pizza shops. You know, they have to take challah. But that's supposed to be given to the Kohen. He also gets, when he's in the Beit HaMikdash, he gets portions of the sacrifices. Right. Also the Bikurim. There are things that he gets that are given to him, you know, beyond these things. Also, in general, they do have sources of income besides this. First of all, they're allowed to work in professions, right? And they were, even in ancient times, there were professions. There were, you know, blacksmiths and, you know, merchants and that stuff. Plus, they have small plots of land that they can grow things on. They can grow vegetables and beans, maybe very small amounts of grain. Around the cities of Levi'im, there's a 1,000 amma band of little gardens that they can... Right, right. They're not large enough to grow enough crops to actually support your family on, but you can, you know, do those things. Okay. But the fact that it's difficult for them economically, you know, that again, it's worth understanding this when you learn Tanakh. Read Sefer Shoftim, right? And then the Ish Levi that's, you know, for example, at the end of Sefer Shoftim, the one who's going around looking for a job, and he winds up becoming a Kohen to the Pesel of Micha. And if you remember the story there, part of the situation here is that he's in a bad situation. Now, what he could be doing is what he's supposed to be doing, which is inspiring the people. And again, I have to get to Mishnayot, but, and I see I'm not going to get to this, so just to come back to what you were saying before, once we're talking about this, the lady who sits on his couch and does something, this has to be given to Levi'im. But it doesn't say, it's not that we create a pot and the Levi'im divide it up equally. The farmer has the right to choose which Levi gets it, or which Kohen gets it, yes.
Well, so personality's
going to count. And assumedly, right, the guy spent time with you and helped you out in the ways he's supposed to, and the other guy sat on his couch watching TV, so who's going to get the money, right? So maybe that's that gray area there between the gift and between the chelef avodah that we were talking about before, right? I'm fighting my urge because I can give a whole speech here, but I've thought about this for a long time, about the there's a lot of relevance here to, you know, to debates in contemporary politics about taxation and things like that. And those from the States know the big debate there is about public education and voucher systems. And right here you have a situation where there's money that's set aside for education. The government doesn't have any control of it. There's no board of education. It's sort of like a voucher system, right? It has to be given to the educators. But the farmer gets to choose who gets it. It can't be done for any other purpose. The government doesn't get their hands on it. It's a fascinating... There's a lot to talk about here. But we are supposed to be learning Mishnayot, that I have 11 minutes, so let's at least look at some of the details here. Okay, tomorrow we'll be able to focus more directly on the Mishnayot. It's just... there's just so much here, and I wanted to give you an overview. I had to do it a little bit this way. But here... Yes? You mean that's why he has less money? You mean then?
No, he has more money because he doesn't need it. He doesn't use it. He doesn't give it. He doesn't need more because he does not consume things that are.
As you're saying, so he can live on a smaller income.
And
oh, I see what you're saying. In other words, if he lives a different type of lifestyle. So then he can subsist on a smaller budget and then it won't matter as much.
He's not sacrificing that, that's his job.
Right. It could be. Okay. It's also possible that he has less expenses. You're right. In other words, running a farm, I imagine, costs a certain... the farmer, for example, has to take some of his crop. If he can't... It depends what kind of crop also. But for example, if this wasn't grapes, if this was grain, right? He can't eat or sell all 81 boxes of grains, or he's going to have nothing next year. He has to take some of that wheat and throw it back in the ground to plant for next year's crop. That's an investment, right? I don't know what the percentages are. I'm not a farmer, but some of this he needs for next year's crop. The Levi doesn't. Right, right. He pays workers, exactly. The Levi doesn't. The Levi, right. The Levi's just living off what he gets. So there's probably an economic side to that also, and also the lifestyle point, 100%. Okay, but just like we saw yesterday, to take these abstract principles and live by them, there have to be rules. And we'll see how much of this we can get through. First of all, let's start with a few Mishnayot from Masechet Trumot, which obviously, as the name implies, discusses Truma. Ein tormin zeitim al shemen velo anavim al yayin. Okay, you can give, first of all, each crop has to be done separately. Okay, so if I have, let's say, grapes, I have a vineyard, and I have an olive grove, and I have a patch where I grow some vegetables. I can't take from my, you know, whatever percentage I'm going to give to the Kohen, which we'll see in a minute, from my entire crop, say I have to give this much, I'm going to give it all in grapes. Each crop has to be done separately, and not only that. In theory, it's to be done from the raw produce, but if I didn't, if I took the grapes and I already pressed them into wine, I could take truma from the wine. But it has to be done separately. In other words, like if I had a certain crop of grapes and a certain percentage I pressed into wine and a certain percentage I have not yet pressed into wine, I have to take truma from the wine for the wine and from the grapes from the grapes. Not only can I not take truma from grapes for olives, I can't even take truma from grapes for wine. And similarly with olives and with oil. Each crop has to be done separately. Not only that, but each year's crop has to be done separately. If I have, and this can happen with fruit trees, if I have crops from two different years, they're fiscal years, and I have to treat them separately. I can't throw all. I have some grain from last year and some grain from this year. I can't throw it all together and take truma. I have to take truma from last year's grain, and separately from this year's grain. That's part of the concept of if you've ever learned the Mishnayot, or maybe when you get to next week, when you do Moed, if you get to, I don't know what they're teaching here, but if you learn the first Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, Arba Rashei Shanim Hein, right? There are 4 days of the year called Rosh Hashanah for different things. Tu B'Shvat, we all know, is Rosh Hashanah Le'ilanot, right? And they tell the kids in Gan that it's a birthday party for trees, or here in Israel, they go out and they plant trees. What it actually is, what Tu B'Shvat actually is, again, for those Americans in the room, it's April 15th. It's tax day, or maybe it's January 1st. It's the beginning of a new fiscal year, right? It's any fruits that ripen before that are from last year. Any fruits that ripen after that are for next year. It may affect Maser Sheni and Maser Ani. But for example, meaning between the 5th year and the 6th year, it'll matter. Between the 4th year and the 5th year, though, it won't matter. The fruit from the 4th year is obligated to Maser Sheni, and the fruit from the 5th year is obligated to Maser Sheni, but still it has to be done separately. You could take them all to Yerushalayim together, but you have to take 10% of this from Maaser Sheni, and the exact same fruits from the next year, separate. Skip a little bit here. This Mishnah, Perek Gimel Mishnah Chet, the second Mishnah on the second page. This is interesting. There's an aspect to these laws that, if you think about it, is very, very fascinating. I have to separate out these different allocations, and when I do so, things happen. When I declare fruit as mas, as truma, it becomes the property of Kohanim, I'm not allowed to take it anymore, and in the case of truma, it becomes holy. Okay, when I declare it as maser rishon, it's no longer mine. If I then decide to eat it, I'm stealing. It belongs to the lady. And this is done without any physical action. You don't even have to physically separate it. You just have to designate it. You just have to make a statement. That's truma, that's maser. And our words create a reality. That's a fascinating concept. What happens if I made a mistake? What happens if I was trying to separate truma, and by mistake I said, that's maser? I said the wrong word. Right? Like you ever try to make a bracha, and you're eating a cookie, and you say, bori pri adama, by mistake or something? What do you do then? So the Mishnah tells you, hamitkaven lomar truma. V'amar ma'aser. If someone tried to separate truma, but by mistake he said ma'aser, or the opposite, ma'aser v'amar truma. Or, the Mishnah then discusses other examples of this in other areas of halacha. If you're designating an animal to be brought as a korban, as a sacrifice, that also has significance. You say this animal is a korban, you can't change your mind and use that animal for anything else now. But what if you said it, you meant to say that this animal is a korban ola, one type of sacrifice. V'amar shlamim, and by mistake you said a different type of sacrifice. You said shlamim, or shlamim, v'amar ola, etc. In all those cases, the Mishnah says at the end, lo amar klum, ad shehepiv v'libo shavim. Then your statement has no significance. We could have said one of two things. You called it truma, but you meant to call it maaser, maybe it became truma. Or maybe it became maaser, which is what you meant to say. The Mishnah says neither one. If you meant to say one thing, and you said the other thing, then the entire sentence is thrown out, nothing happened, everything remains as it was, and until your word matches what your intention, then the statement was invalid. How much are you supposed to give for truma? Perek Dalad Mishnah Gimel. We saw yesterday the peah. The Mishnah said that peah has no shi'ur, has no limit or no specific measurement in the Torah. And the rabbis came along and regulated and said 1/60. Truma is the same way. The Torah didn't give us a amount. It told us how much ma'aser is. It told us how much truma ma'aser is, a tenth of a tenth. And it told us how much ma'aser sheni is, or ma'aser ani. It didn't tell us how much truma is. And therefore the rabbis understood that truma is like peah, in the sense that in theory, min ha-Torah, it could be fulfilled with the slightest amount. But the rabbis, as they did with peah, created a limit. They don't want the kohanim to people giving them a few little crumbs. They want it to be something significant. But here, they gave us a range. Fascinating. Shi'ur truma. Ayin yafeh. If someone is generous, may arba'im. That means 1/40. Beit Shammai omrim, mishloshim, 1/30. Beit Shammai has an even larger number for the generous amount of truma. But we go by Beit Hillel, by 1/40. Habeinonit, average, mechamishim, 1/50. The hara'a, and the cheap, the stingy people, with the ayin ra'a, the people, the misers, the minimum that must be given is echad mishishim, is 1/60. Okay, so yesterday, the peah also. Their peah, it said a minimum of 1/60, but you should give more if necessary. Here, they structured it more. And that's why I decided to start this example with 102. I had our guy be roughly benoni. An average person gives 1/50. He actually gave a tiny bit less than 1/50 because I wanted to make the numbers work out. So I had him start with 102, right? Which is slightly less than 2%, which is 1/50. So he gave basically the average amount, and then we were able to map the rest out there. Okay, I only have 2 minutes, so I want to go to Ma'aser Sheni, but I'll just tell you, the Mishnayot here in Ma'asrot discuss a whole other fascinating aspect of this. These crops, these requirements are meant to be done from the finished product. While you're still working, it doesn't apply. Okay, so for example, the farmer can pick things in the fields while he's working and eat them, even though he hasn't taken Truma and Ma'aser yet. Only when he creates the finished product and it's ready to either be taken into his house and eaten or ready to go to market, depending on what he's going to do with it, only then does it become obligated in these mitzvot. And this has plenty of ramifications nowadays as well. If you have fruit tree in your garden here in Israel, you can pick a grape off the vine and eat it. But the minute you take it into your house, you can't eat it anymore until you deal with all these things here. Also, if it's hefker, if it has no owner, then it's also exempt. So if you're out on a tiyul someplace and you pick wild berries, right? If you're with someone who knows which wild berries are safe to eat, and then you do so, if you're in the woods or something like that, then it also doesn't need. Okay. In my 1 minute left, I just want to discuss Ma'aser Sheni a little bit. Ma'aser Sheni. Ma'aser Sheni, again, is unique in the sense that I own it myself. I'm taking it to Yerushalayim to eat. There are restrictions on what I can do with it. First of all, Ma'aser Sheni, Ein Mochrin Oto. I'm not allowed to sell it. A Kohen can sell Truma. Nothing wrong with that. Now, obviously, the only one who's going to buy it is going to be another Kohen. And it's sold at a lower rate than regular food, because why would you pay the same price for food that's restricted in its use? So Truma has a lower market value than the exact same product would have if it wasn't Truma. And the Gemara discusses this, but there's no problem. There's a market. There's a market for Kohanim selling Truma among themselves. Right? You got a lot of Truma. You don't have, someone gave you a case of olive oil. You don't need it. So you sell it to your neighbor, or you trade it with him. He got too much of this, whatever. That's fine. Ma'aser Sheni, you're not allowed to sell. And you can't use it as the collateral for a loan, and you can't trade it for something else. If you transfer the kedusha, the holiness of Ma'aser Sheni, to money, what are you allowed to do with it? You have to take it to Yerushalayim and buy things with it. What can you buy with it?
So transferring it, you're saying you have to make a statement?
There are two ways to do it. One way to do it is to actually sell it to somebody who buys it from you. No, you can't sell it as Ma'aser Sheni. But if I'm up there in the Golan, I can sell it to a customer who buy it for fair market value. When he gets it, it loses its holiness, and the money that he pays for it is now the money I take to Yerushalayim. Or I could do it myself by making a declaration. If I do it myself, I'm supposed to add 20%. 25%. 25% to the value. I'm really out of time, so let me just say. Mishnah Gimel tells us that you can buy various types of food with it, but not all types of food. The ideal thing to do with it, by the way, is to buy meat, to buy an animal, to bring that animal as a korban shlamim, which is a form of sacrifice that is eaten. Right? And a korban shlamim, a certain portion of the animal goes on the altar, on the mizbeach, a certain portion is given to the kohanim in the Beit HaMikdash, and the majority of the meat is eaten by the owner, by the person who brought it. That's the ideal thing to do with the money of Maaser Sheni, which again, I think, emphasizes what we were talking about before. It also, by the way, goes to part of your question, what are you going to do with all the money? Now you're buying a whole animal, and you're not even eating the whole animal, so you know that also could be part of it. But you can also buy other things. You can buy meat, you can buy fruits, vegetables, things made from them, like wine and oil. You cannot buy, however, things that didn't grow from the ground. For example, you can't buy salt. You want to cook your own dinner, you can't use Maaser Sheni money to buy salt. Salt is not considered an agricultural product at all. It's a mineral. And therefore, since this came from agriculture, the Torah says it has to stay in that realm. You can even buy meat. Animals are also an agricultural product. They're indirectly a product of the land. You can't buy fish, though. The fish live in the ocean, right? They're not supported by the system of the rains and everything that grows from the ground. You can buy things that you're only allowed to use it for food or for they used to use oil as skin treatment, right? And that's considered a form of consumption. But for example, you cannot use the oil of Maaser Sheni to light your home with or to light your hotel room in Yerushalayim with. They used to use oil also for lighting. You can't use it for that. Okay, so that's the basic overview to these things. I apologize for having squeezed a little bit too much into 1 hour, but the goal was to give you a bit of an overview. And tomorrow, we're going to talk about something really fascinating, which is what happens in the year, in a Shemitah year. And we'll see that none of these laws apply. Not the laws we learned about yesterday. There's no leket, shichah, and peah. And not the laws we talked about today. Partly because there's no agricultural activity, but there are crops. And Shemitah is also of great relevance. Of all these laws, it's the law that we can come closest. We're still far from fully observing it, but we can come closest to observing it properly. And it's exciting because in a little over a year, we're going to have a Shnat Shemitah here. Correct. Well, if you're relying on the Heter Mechira, then your things that are grown that way are considered to be outside of the rules of Shemitah. So then you don't. But there are other ways. One of the trends today is to try to minimize the use of the Heter Mechira and possible and to use other methods like the Otzer Beit Din, which do allow us to have the Shemitah observed more properly. Yeah.